On RN, Lynn Malcolm with you for All in the Mind. Today, the most important brain in the world.
Gonna take a sentimental journey.
I don't remember things.
Uh-huh. Do you know what you did yesterday?
No, I don't.
How about this morning?
I don't even remember that.
Could you tell me what you had for lunch today?
I don't know. Tell you the truth.
What do you think you'll do tomorrow?
Whatever's beneficial.
Good answer.
Henry Mollison was widely known in the field of neuroscience as HM until his identity was revealed after his death in 2008.
He showed the world that the removal of the hippocampal region, that is the inner part of the temporal lobe, causes amnesia.
Suzanne Corkin, Professor Emeritus of Neuroscience in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT. She spent countless intensive hours over 5 decades talking with him and testing him, but he never knew who she was. Today, we hear her story of working with Henry Mollison, as she's written in her recent book, Permanent Present Tense, The Man with No Memory and What He Taught the World. Henry Mollison was born in Connecticut in 1926 and as a boy had severe epilepsy. In 1953, Dr. William Beatrice Scovell gave him what he referred to as a frankly experimental operation to relieve his epileptic condition. 2 holes were drilled in his skull, and the front part of his hippocampus on both sides and most of his amygdala were sucked out. The idea was to remove the parts of the brain which were causing his fits. But the unexpected and devastating consequence of the operation was that he, from that day on, lost the ability to lay down new long-term memories. His world was turned upside down, yet unbeknownst to him, he began his invaluable contribution to our scientific understanding of memory. His case was first reported in a paper by William Scovell and Brenda Milner in 1957. So what made him such a good subject for the study of memory? Suzanne Corkin.
His damage was much more circumscribed than we see in other amnesic patients because it was caused by a precise surgical intervention. The tissue was carved out explicitly. And it wasn't caused by a brain disease like encephalitis or a tumor. His lesion was localized and his amnesia was pure. It means that his other intellectual functions were intact, that his language and his perceptual skills were normal. His IQ was consistently above average, so he was an intelligent person. He just had a horrible memory. And in addition, he had no psychiatric symptoms, and in particular, he was not depressed.
So give us a sense of what it was like to talk to him, to be with him, and what his daily life was like because of this memory impairment.
Well, he was a really gentle person. People describe him as a, quote, gentle soul. He was intelligent, he was friendly, and he was altruistic. But he was also an excellent research participant. In spite of his amnesia, he understood test instructions, and he always tried to do his best. When I asked him about how he felt about doing so many tests, he'd say, whatever I can do to help others. So the altruism kept showing through.
Neuropsychologist Jenny Ogden, now based in New Zealand, was one of the hundreds of scientists who've worked with HM. She considers herself lucky enough to have been doing postdoctoral research in Suzanne Corkin's lab in the mid-80s.
It was very exciting to have the opportunity to meet HM, and like everyone else who works with HM, of course I have exactly the same experience. Because he has really made no new memories since he was 16 actually, so all his memories, all the things he talks about are the same things over and over and over again, and everyone who works with HM, when they go for example to a conference, they can get together and they can all repeat exactly the same stories with exactly the same intonations as HM did it. So that's very amusing, and there doesn't seem to be anything different about HM when you first meet him. Mm. Hello, Henry. How are you? I'm having an argument with myself. I think I'm all right or whatever. And he talks away to you, perfectly normal. And then you move away and you come back and you realise that he has no idea that he's ever spoken to you before. And it's really quite unbelievably dramatic, actually. He always seems content and smiling and happy. He lives in the moment. You know, he lives in a 7-second moment and he doesn't remember anything before that or after that. He can converse almost normally and respond to you. But if you distract him, he can then repeat the same story over and over again. He repeats the story about why he decided not to be a brain surgeon, which is related to his own operation. And then you can distract him by mentioning something else and then cueing him in, and he'll tell you exactly the same story again, you know, 1 minute later. But he was a delight to work with. And, of course, you'd give him these boring experiments and, you know, the same things over and over and over and over again. But he was never bored because he'd never seen him before. That was one of the wonders about HM. He was such a joy to work with. You know, you couldn't help but be fond of him.
What we learned, first of all, was something that's called the dual process theory of memory, and that is that you have what William James initially called primary memory or short-term memory, and secondary memory or long-term memory. And immediate memory is something that has never left your consciousness. It's the right now. Whereas long-term memory is something that is brought back, fished up, or recalled. And Henry's immediate memory was preserved. So if I said to him, 3, 6, 9, 8, 5, he could say back to me, 3, 6, 9, 8, 5, right? It was because it was still in consciousness. Of course, what he couldn't do is if I left the room and someone else went in to talk to him for a minute and then I came back again and said, Henry, do you remember any of those digits? Well, he wouldn't remember that I'd even said a string of digits to him. So once he was distracted, the slate was completely erased and he pretty much lost it.
Suzanne Corkin says that Henry Mollison's case launched the modern era of memory research. And she highlights three major scientific contributions.
First of all, Henry was living proof that you can be an intelligent person and still have a dreadful memory. His IQ was above average over all the years that we tested him. And this tells us that memory is processed by specialized brain circuits, that memory is compartmentalized in the brain. The second big contribution is that he showed us that the ability to form new memories is localized to a specific part of the brain. Before Henry, we didn't understand that the hippocampal region is essential for the establishment of long-term memory. The third contribution was the discovery that not all kinds of learning and memory are impaired in amnesia. So his case inaugurated thousands of studies in patients and in healthy people showing that there are different kinds of memory with different addresses in the brain. So this understanding of different memory circuits localized to different brain areas was a groundbreaking revelation. Now, Brenda Milner in Montreal provided the first evidence of this dissociation in 1962 by showing that he could learn a motor skill that he practiced over 3 days, even though he never remembered the test apparatus or how well he had done, or Milner herself, his skill improved. So he learned the procedure. He learned the how to do it. Since then, countless researchers have fleshed out this idea of multiple memory circuits.
So explain the role of the hippocampus for memory.
So the hippocampus is very important for encoding new information and consolidating information and then helping the process of storage. So the storage of your general knowledge of the world occurs all over the cortex. When I ask you, for example, what the capital of France is, you're engaging circuits in your brain that tell you the correct answer, circuits in your cortex. And what happens is that there is a very important interaction and conversation between the hippocampus and the cortex in the process of laying down long-term memories. For semantic knowledge, your general knowledge of the world, like what a jacuzzi is or what the capital of France is, this information eventually becomes independent of the hippocampus and is stored throughout the cortex. So Henry, in fact, had his semantic knowledge from before his operation. That's why his vocabulary was so good. And he knew about World War II and the stock market crash and important national events like that.
But he didn't have a detailed memory of that history, did he, before the operation?
That's right. So what the hippocampus does is to help you, it's essential for retrieving these explicit memories of something that happened at a particular time and place. He could not remember a unique event from before his operation. And we worked very, very hard to try and pull these memories out of him. For example, as early as 1992, I asked him if he could recall anything about his mother or his father, a birthday, a holiday, an illness, something that happened once and only once, and he just couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. So what he was left with was the gist of his preoperative life. He semanticized it. So he could tell you about all the schools that he went to. He could tell you about the different addresses where he lived, the names of his neighbors. He could tell you about his hobbies, going roller skating, taking banjo lessons, going ice skating, all the various activities he did with his friends. But he could never tell you what happened on a specific day at a specific time.
Have we ever met before, you and I?
Yes, I think we have.
Where?
Well, in high school.
In high school?
Yes.
Have we ever met any place besides high school?
Well, to tell you the truth, I can't know. I don't think so.
He also believed that he knew you, didn't he, from the past?
Yes, he did. Of course, he never really knew who I was. But beginning in the 1980s, he'd say that he knew me from high school. So why did he think that? Well, over the years, he built up a sense of familiarity for my face and for my name. From 1966 on, he visited us at the MIT Clinical Research Center on 50 occasions, each time for a week or two. So he heard Suzanne Corkin over and over and over again at the Clinical Research Center, also at his nursing home. And he saw my face on many occasions. As a result of this constant repetition, he believed that he knew me. Now, why would he say he knew me from high school? Well, if you think about it, that was the last large group of people that he belonged to. After that, his life was very isolated. So if he wanted to locate me within a group of people, that's, you know, was the most available one for him to situate me in. And so he did.
What were some of the really surprising things about Henry's memory? Things that you couldn't predict or expect?
Yes. Well, interestingly, he spent a lot of time watching television and reading magazines. And he would actually look at the same magazine over and over again, not knowing he had already read it. So he had a lot of exposure to the media and celebrities. And so it turns out that he was able to pick up a few little crumbs of information about famous people. Through a lot of exposure, he could give accurate, distinguishing information about a small number of people. Now, this experiment was done by Gail O'Kane and Elizabeth Kenzinger, published in 2004. The way the experiment went was they would show him two names. One was a famous name, and the other was a name picked from the Boston phone book. And so all he had to do was say, which of the two names is famous? And we had names from preoperative years, and we had names from postoperative years, so pre-1953, post-1953. For the preoperative names, not surprisingly, 92% of the time he knew which of the two names was famous. For the postoperative names, surprisingly, he was correct 88% of the time. So these were people who became famous after his operation in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So then they took this experiment one step further and they said, well, Henry, why were these people famous? And for about eight people, he could give these little factlets. For example, for Julie Andrews, he said she was famous for singing on Broadway. For JFK, he said, became president, somebody shot him and he didn't survive, he was Catholic. John Glenn, he said, was the first rocketeer, landed on the moon, stayed a while, returned safely. Not completely correct, but he has the essence of it. Mm. Woody Allen, a comic in movie pictures. Liza Minnelli, a movie star, actress, dancer, too. So these people obviously captured his fancy. I think that there is an emotional component to his surprising memory for these few people. Julie Andrews and Liza Minnelli were very talented, and I'm sure Henry was very fond of them. Kennedy didn't really come to prominence until the 1960s, but his family had been famous. His father was the ambassador to England before World War II. And also they were Catholic, so I'm sure that when JFK died, that he and his mother were just glued to the television watching the conversations after. And maybe Woody Allen, Henry had a very good sense of humor, and this may be why Woody Allen, who sometimes is comical, would appeal to him.
So what light has it cast on that connection between emotions and memory?
Well, we know from other experiments that we did in our lab and many other labs as well, that your memory for emotional information is much better than your memory for neutral information. So, for example, all of us in the U.S., and maybe you too, have very vivid memories of the terrorist attack on 9/11. We can tell you, you know, where we were, what we were doing, and we have very vivid memories ingrained in our brains and our hearts. It's that kind of thing that's indelible. In contrast, one of the huge events in the U.S. is our Super Bowl. You know, the final football competition to figure out who is the very best team. It's a very big deal. But after it's over, people don't remember the details, unless it was their home team that won or lost. Mm-hmm. They don't remember the excruciating details like you do for an event that's very emotional.
Track that takes me back.
Neuroscientist Suzanne Corkin. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and you're with All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia, and online. We're hearing about the famous case of H.M., the man who, after an operation on his brain to relieve his severe epilepsy, completely lost his long-term memory. So having worked so closely with him over so many years on memory, what are your reflections and conclusions now about the significance of memory and its effect on our identity as a human being?
Yes, this is a great question because scholars ranging from philosophers to neuroscientists have argued that an individual who lacks the capacity to remember also lacks an identity. So did Henry have a sense of self? And the answer is yes, absolutely he did. But it was less complete than ours. Our notion of self is a composite of our memories from the past and the present, and also our plans from the future. And when we examine Henry's access to these time periods, we find that it was patchy. So I've already told you about the preoperative years, that he had wonderful memory of the facts that he was exposed to during his life, but he had no episodic autobiographical memories. But in terms of the present, his memory was decimated, but he did have some selective insights and fragments of information about his own situation. So in this sense, he did have an identity. He was aware from before his operation that he had epilepsy, and he also knew that he had an operation on his head. That's the way he phrased it, on his head. He didn't say in my brain. He also had the feeling that the procedure, he had the feeling it had been tried on only a few people before him, and that during his operation, something had gone amiss. And of course, he knew he didn't remember things. He knew he had a bad memory, and he would frequently say, "I don't remember." But an interesting side effect of this is that because he couldn't record any new information, his body image was outdated. So he knew he was tall, but he described himself as thin but heavy. And he was unaware that he had gray hair. And for a long time after his parents died, he wasn't really sure whether they were living or not living. And he carried a little note in his pocket that said, "Dad is gone, Mom is well." So his information about his present was definitely very, very patchy. And also he wasn't well informed about his internal states. He didn't have a good appreciation of hunger and thirst. He never said, oh, I'm hungry. When is the next meal? Of course, he would never know whether the next meal was breakfast, lunch, or dinner, because he didn't know where he was in the day unless he looked at the clock. But he also couldn't appreciate pain. His pain threshold was very high, possibly related to the amygdala lesion. For many years, he had very bad hemorrhoids, and they were operated on at one point, but he never complained about them. You know, he just accepted this, and maybe they weren't as painful as they would have been to other people. But another really interesting thing is that when it came to looking into the future, he was at a loss. He couldn't construct an agenda. Many times over, he stated that he wanted to be a brain surgeon, but he couldn't because he wore glasses, and he had different scenarios of how wearing glasses would prohibit his being a surgeon. But that said, he never had a plan B or a plan C or a plan D. And, you know, he was just left with nothing, which is really, it's really sad. When I asked him what he thought he would do tomorrow, he said, whatever is beneficial. Full stop. He couldn't create a future, and he was never able to chase his dreams because he didn't have any.
Henry sadly passed away in 2008, and
yes,
it must have been a very emotional time for you. You became very close to him, didn't you?
Yes.
How did that feel? And also, what practical things did you have to do to continue the value that Henry had already offered to neuroscience?
Right. Let me backtrack a little. In 1992, it was clear to me that to make optimal use of all the wonderful, rich behavioral data that we were collecting on Henry, that it would be necessary to obtain his brain at autopsy and see exactly what structures had been removed and what structures remained, because we not only wanted to explain the cause of his memory impairment, but we also wanted to explain the things that he could remember and all his preserved cognitive capacities. So in 1992, I talked with Henry and his conservator, and I explained, first of all, what a valuable research participant Henry was. And I think Henry had an implicit sense of this himself. And so I explained that if they were willing to sign a brain donation form, then we would be able to carry the science forward after he died. And they agreed to this, and Henry signed the brain donation form in 1992. And that gave his brain, in fact his whole body, to Mass General Hospital and MIT for future research. So we are the owners of his brain, and that's how the research is able to go forward. Now, as he got older, and I could see that he was dwindling, his health wasn't great. So I thought, you know, we better really plan on what we're going to do, because this is the most famous brain in the world, and we don't want to botch this autopsy.
In preparation for his death, Suzanne Corkin assembled a team of scientists and MRI brain scanning specialists to plan their strategy for the sad day.
Now, when I got the call that he died, of course, my heart dropped down to my stomach. But because we had prepared for 7 years for this one phone call, I had to immediately jump into action. And so what I did was to make the calls that were necessary to mobilize the people to do the scanning that night at Mass General, and the neuropathologist to alert him that we needed to do the autopsy the next morning, and so he could make preparations at the morgue so everything would go smoothly. And that's what happened. One of the key issues was time is of the essence, because brain tissue and bodily tissue deteriorate fairly quickly over time. So we actually had him in the MRI scanner just under 4 hours from the time he died. We scanned him for 9 hours that night and did an amazing series of MRI scans. Oh, and you asked me about me and how I felt. Mm-hmm. Well, up until that point, I hadn't really had a chance to connect with my own feelings. But I was there during the 9 hours of scanning. I wasn't very helpful at all. I was in the outer room. But I had my laptop with me, and that's when I wrote his obituary. And that's when it suddenly fell on me as, you know, a cloud of sadness. It's like, Henry's gone, you know. And, I don't know what to say. Mm. It was a sad time.
After the many years Henry Mollison spent as the subject of memory studies in the lab, combined with the invaluable extra information made possible by the autopsy and the brain scans conducted after his death, Henry's contribution to our understanding of memory has been enormous and has inspired many students to pursue careers in neuroscience. Suzanne Corkin.
An immediate benefit of Henry's contribution was to other patients. So his catastrophe put neurosurgeons all over the world on notice that they mustn't remove the hippocampal region on both sides of a patient's brain for any reason at all. Because if they did, that person would definitely become amnesic. Then an offshoot of this knowledge was that neurosurgeons who wanted to remove these key memory structures on one side of a patient's brain, say the left, had to be darn sure that the corresponding structures on the right side were intact. Because if the right side were damaged, then removing the memory area on the left would cause a bilateral lesion similar to Henry's, and amnesia would follow. Now, later on, to help in this decision, researchers designed a procedure that they carried out in the hospital just before the operation to establish the integrity of the supposedly intact memory circuitry so that Henry's case would not be repeated.
Do you think at any time Henry had any idea of the impact that he would have on neuroscience?
On several occasions, I would thank him, of course, for what he was doing, and I would tell him how important it was. And I would say, you know, Henry, you're famous. People all over the world know who you are, and they know about your wonderful contributions to science and how things are going to be better for other patients because of you. And, you know, he would just sort of smile sheepishly, sort of took it in his stride, and I'm sure it warmed his heart. But naturally, the minute he was distracted, he forgot it. So sadly, the world will remember him to a much greater extent than he could even appreciate his own importance to the world and to science.
How do you feel about answering so many questions and doing all the tests that we give you?
Well, I don't mind. What is found out about me helps you to help others. And that, I figure that's more important in a way.
Henry Mollison, in a recording he did with Suzanne Corkin, Emeritus Professor of Neuroscience in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT. That's the show for today. Visit the All in the Mind website at abc.net.au/radionational, and there you'll find details of Suzanne Corkin's book and a link to her website. Thanks for your company. See you next week. Now, stay with RN for the Philosopher's Zone with Joe Gelonesi.